Blog Talk Radio.
And this is the Mr. Media interview. Do you remember the first music you ever bought? Whether it was a digital download, a compact disc, cassette, 8-track, or a 33 and a third, 45, or even a 78 RPM wax record, I'll bet you know that first song or album by heart. Mine was way back in 1967, the Monkees' Headquarters album. My parents bought it at the neighborhood pharmacy, believe it or not. I played it over and over and over again. I would have kept playing it, but my little brother Ira, the future disc jockey, took a bite out of it, literally. I still have it, though. Oh, no laughing at the introduction. Sorry.
Sorry.
That's all right. I still have it, though. And no matter what kind of music you like, whether it's Bruce Springsteen, Lawrence Welk, or Gwen Stefani, we all form attachments to our favorite songs. For example, the first song my wife and I danced to at our wedding was Springsteen's Little Girl, I Want to Marry You. And it still brings a smile to my face almost 20 years later. The point of these anecdotal snapshots? Music matters in our lives. But the music industry itself is undergoing a historic shift away from the sale of physical albums to downloads of music, one 99-cent song at a time. Where is pop music going? That's the topic of today's interview with Tamara Conniff, executive editor and associate publisher of Billboard, where she oversees all aspects of the Billboard brand, from editorial to face-to-face events. She is the youngest person and first woman to hold this post. Prior to joining Billboard, Conniff served as the music editor for The Hollywood Reporter for 5 years and was senior editor in charge of music for Amusement Business. Her work has also appeared in the Los Angeles Times, the Los Angeles Daily News, the Boston Globe, and the New York Post, among other places. Born and raised in Hollywood, she is also the daughter of the late American music legend, Ray Conniff. Tamara, welcome to Mr. Media.
Thank you.
Glad that I tickled your funny bone there.
Yes, that was funny.
Let me ask you, is American Idol the greatest thing to happen in music, to the music industry since Ahmet Erdogan, or is it the worst development since Milli Vanilli?
I think it's a little bit of both, actually. What's interesting is industry observers during the first season of American Idol, you know, when it first started, we were convinced it was going to be dead in the water. And here we are multiple seasons later and millions of albums sold. I think what Idol really does represent is just the shift in the music industry of, you know, a texting-oriented generation. American Idol really sort of ushered in the whole text voting, which translates to ringtones and purchasing music with your mobile phone. It also really showed that the marketing power of television over traditional media like radio. So it showed that shift in music. And I would say that out of all the idols, you know, there are two breakout stars three, you know, Carrie Underwood and Jennifer Hudson. And, of course, Kelly Clarkson are actually really fantastic singers. Is it, you know, teen sugar pop at its best or worst? Absolutely. Has it affected the ability for young artists who do not have that kind of exposure to get signed and be promoted? Yes.
In a positive or a negative way?
Negative.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
You think it's closed doors?
It has absolutely closed doors to a lot of artists in the business. The one question that record label executives ask themselves is when they sign a young artist, how do they break them if they don't have a platform? You know, American Idol is a platform.
Right.
You know, so unless they can't, there are options of taking an artist, how they would normally do it would be to, you know, promote at radio, do a couple radio shows, maybe do a mall tour, depending on the age. But now, you know, those avenues don't hold the power. So unless you have television, either American Idol or maybe Grey's Anatomy or one of the hit shows really championing your artist, it's very hard to take an unknown artist and break them.
Wow. So would you say, as those doors have closed, has the industry also gotten a little lazy?
I don't think it's laziness as much as it is fear.
Hmm.
I think you're dealing with, you know, in your introduction you talked about the first album that you had in 1967. You look back at the 60s and the 70s, record companies were independent, you know. A&M was an independent company.
Mm-hmm.
They weren't owned by these big conglomerates who are, you know, forcing record executives to meet quarterly numbers. The music industry isn't like making cereal.
Mm-hmm.
You never know when you're going to have a hit or not have a hit, or, you know, EMI was late with releasing the Coldplay album and their stock plummeted.
Mm-hmm.
You know, back in the day, those issues weren't a concern to music companies. They'd wait for years for the record to come out.
Right.
So it's not laziness as much as it is fear and trying to find something that's going to help you meet those numbers.
Has the industry also come full circle in the last 40 years? Boy, I'm dating myself. But in the 60s, the 50s and 60s, even the 40s for that matter, it was really a singles industry. I mean, we sold, you know, there were albums, but it was really, people were buying 45s and single songs. Then we went through these years of the rock albums and, you know, the whole concept and the album. You'd be buying a whole album. There was album radio. And now we're really at that point, aren't we, with the 99-cent downloads and some new artists aren't even recording a whole album. They record a song, and if they sell enough copies, maybe then they get an album.
Well, the industry, the interesting thing is that it was really the record industry that kind of screwed themselves on this one. The record companies actually took singles off the market about 15 years ago. And the reason why they did that is because singles were cannibalizing record sales.
Mm.
People weren't buying the 15, or then it was probably a $12 album. They were buying a, you know, a $2 single. So the record companies thought, well, why should we offer singles and they're not buying the album? We'll force them to buy the whole album for the single. So they were releasing, at that time, a lot of albums that were a whole lot of fluff with one strong song, and consumers essentially had to pay $12 to get that album.
Right.
This is also during a time where soundtracks were very successful because soundtracks are essentially a collection of singles. So what happened with the advent of the technology and the peer-to-peer sharing technology is the consumer got really smart and said, I'm paying $15 for an album that sucks because I like one song.
Mm-hmm.
So here's this new service, and I go get it for free.
Yeah, I agree with that completely. I know the reason I stopped buying records was I was just sick of having to, you know, spend that much money, and really all I wanted was one song.
Right. So you're looking at a situation where the record companies kind of did to themselves, are we in a singles market again? Absolutely, but that's because of how record companies have been making albums.
Mm.
And also because of technology.
How far does the American Idol approach, how far can it go in terms of, obviously it's still drawing like crazy. As we're talking, they're winding up what I guess is the sixth season. I read where they're talking about spinning off a show that's band oriented, and of course we have Rockstar, Mark Burnett show, and Dancing with the Stars, which is just kind of a variation, more focused on dance but heavy music. And how far can all this go? Will we have more programs? Will we sell more records this way, or will it have to start to swing back at some point soon?
At some point, everything swings back.
Mm.
Everything has a life cycle, as, you know, pop music has a life cycle. I mean, you can go back to the sort of the real sugary doo-wop of the 50s, which is in no way dissimilar from, you know, NSYNC or the Backstreet Boys. So you've got, I think that this phase will pass, and then another phase will begin, and then probably another 15, 20 years from now, we'll go back to pop music and we'll have another American Idol, which in many ways is sort of like American Bandstand.
Right.
Except for the voting aspect of it. It's all cyclical, I think.
What we've talked a little bit about what may be wrong with the industry at the moment. What's right about the music industry? What can it brag about? What's it doing right today?
Oh, that's a very good question.
I was afraid from your brief silence that there was no answer.
and I actually have to think about what they're doing right. They are actively embracing new technologies, finally, even though they're a little late. They have some of the companies, EMI being the forerunner, mm-hmm. Have said bye-bye to DRM.
And digital rights management.
Digital rights management, which is a big plus for consumers.
And do you think, and I wanted to ask you about this, do you think other labels are going to follow it because it's the right thing to do or because it's their opportunity to get an extra 30 cents a song for downloads?
No, I mean, I think that you have to do it. DRM was, I know I'm kind of opinionated about this, but DRM is sort of like Reagan's Star Wars, you know? Like, what are you doing? Essentially, you're punishing consumers who want to buy music
right.
by making it impossible for them to use it on the devices they want to use it on. And the people who are going to steal it anyway.
Hmm.
So I think that, DRM was a huge waste of money, and it's a torture to consumers who seek to buy music legally. And I think eventually all the labels are going to have to abandon it.
Does the fact that it reached this deal with that EMI reached this deal with iTunes just have iTunes was already standing high apart from everyone else? Does it now put someone standing on its shoulders, making it that much harder that anyone will ever catch up to it?
I don't know. I mean, I think iTunes. The irony about iTunes and their DRM strategy is that they were like the worst culprits of DRM. With the rights management surrounding, iTunes. Listen, I think that there are a lot of, they had to do this in order because other media players were actually starting to chomp at their heels.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I think that it's a cultural phenomenon, Apple iTunes is. And at some point, it'll swing again, but I don't see it stopping anytime soon.
This is a little broad of where we're going, but has the Zune had any impact in the market at all?
Zune is a really fantastic product. The only problem with Zune is that not enough people have it for it to work.
Mm.
I mean, Zune has a sharing system, and in order to share, you have to have someone who has a Zune.
Right.
So the problem is that it's not mass market yet.
Do you think it ever will be?
I think if they stick to it and continue to adapt it, make it smaller, and find a right promotion for it, I think that it could be a viable competitor. But it was a very advanced product to come into a market that wasn't really ready for it.
It seems I can't. I was just trying to, as you were saying that, I was trying to remember the last time I saw an ad either on TV or in print for the Zune, and I honestly can't remember.
Yeah, I think that they're going back to the drawing board a little bit, for the next incarnation of it.
So we talked about American Idol's impact on the industry. What about iTunes and Apple? Have they played a big role in revolutionizing the music industry?
Well, yeah, I mean, absolutely. They good and bad, I suppose. They've made music portable. They've made downloads legal. They've become a huge marketer of music. They've taken, they've definitely steered people away from peer-to-peer sites where it was free to pay for music. The only problem is that they also set a price point that is 99 cents, and that's a pretty low price point to start from. It's hard to lower that. I think it would have been better for the industry to start it a little higher.
Mm. Of course, there's always been this belief in retail that you want to be under the dollar, whether it's $9.95 being under $10 or 99 cents being under $1.
As you see a the value of music going down, the monetary value of music going down. Mm. You might have wanted to launch it at $299 and been able to have negotiating room to bring the price down.
And how much impact has iTunes and iPods, and for that matter, you know, Zune and SanDisk, and how much impact have they had on radio? Because I know that Billboard covers radio as well.
Well, radio, you know, listen, it's not even that so much. I think the internet has had the biggest impact on radio.
Hmm. How so?
With web radio, with, you know, bloggers being able to do playlists, with webcasts. Hmm. Where the web, on the web is where you find the old school DJs, or what we remember as DJs.
Mm-hmm.
Where you find a community and someone that you taste you like, and you go and you listen to their playlist. That's what DJs used to do.
Right.
So I actually think that internet webcasting and internet radio has been the biggest Achilles heel of terrestrial.
That as opposed to satellite radio.
Satellite radio is a totally different demographic.
Mm.
Your average kid can't afford satellite radio. Nor do they care, or are they going to buy it, you know?
Right.
Satellite radio is for an older consumer, and it certainly has been positive, but I don't think it's really taken that much away from terrestrial.
Okay. Well, let's come back to the music industry. Among the major labels, and even what few independents there are, whose star is rising these days, and whose is falling?
On the label side?
Yeah.
You know what? It's the indies are definitely on the rise. You know, you look at a number of indie labels and indie distributors. You know, a lot, and so many indie releases that have come out. You know, Koch is definitely hot right now. Victory Records has always got something, some great, you know, hardcore rock band. Even Sub Pop, you know, has sort of having a new revolution since the grunge era in signing artists. I think a lot of artists are opting to go with indies because the deal terms are better. The advance money isn't as big, but the deals are better, and the rights are better, and the other thing about the indie labels is that they're much more nimble and able to adapt to changing technologies much faster than the big conglomerates. So, I mean, if I were an artist today, I would definitely look to go with an indie.
It seems like, I mean, there's always been an opportunity in music for independence to rise up. I'm thinking back. I just read a book. I think it was called Mockers and Rockers about Chess Records.
Oh yeah.
And you know, that was a great example of it. You know, who's this guy Chess? Where did he come from?
Right.
Sub Pop, of course, with the whole Seattle, as you mentioned, the grunge. And there's always been that opportunity. So where does this leave the major labels today? I mean, they're merging and they're eating each other alive. Are any of them doing it right?
You know, I think it's a very interesting question. I would say that probably the people who are the furthest along the right path is Warner Music Group, mainly because they've been very forward-thinking about technology, and while they've had a lot of layoffs, they've really trimmed fat and focused on smaller rosters that they can work better, as opposed to over-signing. So I think that Warner is probably... in terms of technology-wise, Warner is sort of the forerunner. Universal Music Group is, of course, the largest. And each label within the Universal Music Group system is very different. And certainly all of the Universal labels have probably among the best leadership in the business. We've got Jimmy Iovine at Interscope, A&M Geffen, who's, you know, brand-oriented and big picture, and or L.A. Reid, who's a music guy through and through, who's you know, taking care of Island Def Jam. So you've got good people in place. It's just the economics are difficult when you've got, and here's the best way I can explain it. 10 years ago, the number one album in the country sold, I don't know, like 2.5 million albums the first week. In January, the number one album sold 70,000.
I wanted to ask you about that. It is astonishing how the change in what's considered a big hit album right now compared to a few years ago. I guess that's, I mean, the buying public's tastes have become that diffuse, I guess, because they have so many options.
No, I don't even think it's that. I think it's, you know, there's a whole generation of consumers out there that have never, ever, ever bought a CD.
Oh.
They don't even, it's like completely foreign to them.
Mm-hmm.
Like a CD, like why... Why would I buy a CD? You know, I'm going to get that off iTunes, or I'm going to get it, you know, from a peer-to-peer service. Or they just have no concept of buying a physical product.
Right.
So they're buying the music, they're buying the ringtones, they're buying the songs. They're just not buying it in a on a physical disc.
I don't imagine my daughter, who's 10, ever buying a CD or whatever follows it. Whereas, I mean, we're still buying the occasional DVD, and of course, there used to be VHS tapes for her. But you know, it's hard to match. She's 10. She's been able to download music for the last 2 years. Why would she want to do anything different?
Yeah, I mean, it's a waste of space.
Yeah. Well, speaking of, let's come back to EMI. But speaking of downloading music, still, what's holding up at this point the Beatles and EMI from getting their music into the digital era?
Rates.
I'm sorry?
You know, it's cost. It's rates.
Yeah? They want more money for it.
Yeah.
That's all it is?
Yeah.
So at $1.29, the deal that EMI struck, you think it'll happen?
I think it will. I mean, I think the Beatles have a very, you know, they are very protective over their music and are not going to give it away cheap. I mean, it is the most popular music in the world. And there's no reason for them to give it away cheap.
Is there a like a bell-shaped curve on this, though? At some point, if they wait too much longer, do they become irrelevant?
No.
Really?
I don't think so.
Hmm. It'd be interesting to see.
I mean, you've got... I honestly don't think so.
Okay. I mean, you know, there's kids my daughter's age who the name The Beatles means absolutely nothing to them.
Yeah, but they also are discovering, I mean, you could still stream Beatles music, so...
Yeah.
You know, I've actually found that more kids are actually discovering the Kinks and the Monkees and, you know, bands are like, how would you even know? And they find them online.
Right, but every day, every year, there's so much more music out there to discover. You know, when I was her age, it was the music from the 50s and the 60s. Now it's, you know, the same type of music. It's the 50s, the 60s, the 70s, the 80s, the 90s, and the aughts. So I wonder if, you know, if they will discover it the same way they might have a few years ago.
I think so.
Yeah. All right. Let's turn to your own publication. How has Billboard changed in the last couple of years, and how will it be different, let's say, 4 or 5 years from now?
Oh, Billboard changed dramatically over the past 3 years. Billboard, for many years, Billboard's 113 years old, and for many years it was a let's say in the past 15 years, it was a very true reflection of the recorded music industry,
mm-hmm.
and where it had its head in the sand about technology, and you know, it wasn't evolving where things were evolving, where. And in much the same way that the record labels were not.
Mm-hmm.
And as a result, you know, we went through kind of a rough patch because, you know, no one was really reading it. It wasn't that interesting to read, which had to do with a lot of different things. You know, you take a trade publication, you take a particular style of reporting, you take an industry that's downsizing and panicked. It was sort of like a tipping point, I think. Or a sea change, or a perfect storm, or one of those buzzwords. and so I came on the Billboard 3 years ago, and at a point where it either needed to change drastically or it was going to continue to go down. And we redesigned it 100%, where it actually, even though it is still a business publication, it looks like a consumer publication.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, just my kind of theory on that was... This isn't your daddy's trade pub, you know. It doesn't have to look like it. It can still have the information in it, but we're in the music industry. We're not. This isn't, you know, a progressive grocer.
Not that there's anything wrong with that.
No, and Progressive Grocer is a sister publication.
Uh-huh.
I say that with a lot of love.
Okay.
We also adapted our coverage dramatically in that we started covering the real music business, which includes advertising agencies, all technology companies, branded entertainment, everything that you can possibly imagine, where music is television, film. So that my theory, sort of mission, I guess, was I wanted the Billboard to be a place where all these different industries could meet and understand each other better.
Mm.
I think one of the biggest hurdles of technology and music is that they don't. It's very different breeds of people, and they don't always speak the same language.
Mm-hmm.
So I kind of used Billboard as a translator tool. Of okay, this big technology has come out. Here's what it means to the music business.
Mm.
And so the music business can go, oh, okay, this is what this technology means. Or, you know, I can explain how contracts work or how deals are struck or with the interests of the record labels that, you know, if they're going to give a single, it has to be part of their overall strategy for an album. They can't just, like, give it to you.
Right.
Which a lot of technology companies thought they could do. So, you know, we definitely try to, we are ahead of the curve instead of on top of it, which is key. Our readership has gone up substantially.
Other
at a time where print is, you know, considered a beast, our print is stronger than ever. And we also developed, we have like, you know, a half dozen e-news products. We have a mobile application. You can get Billboard information on any device you want.
Hmm. Are there any trade publications that you kind of look to at this point, 3 years on, and want to emulate further, or that you admire?
I think when I was looking at the redesign for Billboard, I mean, one of my sort of one of the magazines I looked at was Business Week.
Hmm.
How they organize information, the issues they address, the design, the ease of use. The covers, I mean, you know, Billboard hasn't had covers since 1930, and we now have covers again.
Hmm.
So there's a very, you know, it's very difficult to have a trade publication have a cover. You know, trades are generally, you know, newsprint on the front cover. So I really did look at Business Week as sort of a model.
Hmm. It's a good model.
Yeah.
They've won a few awards. I know you guys won an award recently.
I know. It was so exciting. We actually won an Eddie. We're 100-plus years old, and we've never won an Eddie, so I'm very excited.
It's very good.
Yeah.
Now, before we wind up, I have to ask you, I told a story about growing up in my unspectacular house. I have to tell you that I'm very curious to know what it was like to grow up in the Conniff family. Was there a lot of music?
Oh, I consider myself one of the most blessed humans on the planet. And whenever anyone asks me, you know, is Ray Conniff your father, and say that they're a fan, I always say yes, and I'm proud, and his music is fantastic, but the most important thing about his life is that he was a great father and a great husband.
Mm.
He was truly a family man. You know, my dad, It was always exciting, I guess. Growing up, obviously, music was always in our household. My father was recording up to 2 albums a year for a long period of time.
Mm-hmm.
And later went on to doing just 1 album a year. He toured once a year, and we would take the family with him. So we'd go touring over South America and be treated like, I don't know, like rock stars, right? And then we'd come back to the United States, and our family vacations were, you know, taking my mom, my dad, our animals, and me, and packing us into a motorhome and driving across the country.
Wow.
That was our family vacations. My dad was happiest when he was wearing jeans and, you know, climbing underneath the motorhome. I had a great upbringing, and I was lucky. My dad taught me a lot about business, taught me everything I know about music business.
So. Really? Okay. So I wondered about that. You obviously you're covering music as opposed to making music, which some people might have thought would be a natural progression. Can you play any instruments? Are you musical at all?
Interesting. I mean, I started playing piano when I was 4. I actually played with my father on tour, and I played on albums with him. I never wanted to be, I mean, I am a musician because I play, I studied, but I never wanted to be a performer. I always wanted to be a writer.
Hmm.
I think everyone has their calling, and writing was my calling. And it's ironic that I actually had no intention of being a music writer. I wanted to be a political writer, which is just bizarre. And I guess it's the same thing, sort of. And, you know, you're attracted to what you know, and I guess these opportunities just kept coming up for me. And it's what I know. I mean, if there's anything I know on the planet, it's the music business.
Mm.
So you end up writing what you know, and it sort of happened that way, and I couldn't be happier.
Well, we're coming up on, I guess, what will be the 5th anniversary of your dad's passing. And so, I assume that the Conniff family has an interest in personal interest in music rights and royalties, that kind of thing. What do you think will be? And this will be the last thing we'll touch on. But what do you think will be the music that your dad will be most remembered for, and that will be the most enduring?
It's very interesting. I've been having interesting conversations about my dad's music. You know, a lot of young kids are discovering it.
Mm-hmm.
Who are, you know, on the internet and are really into the sort of, you know, jazzy, hi-fi kind of stuff. I think what my father will be remembered for is as the brilliant arranger that he was. He'll be remembered for the stuff he did with Artie Shaw.
Mm-hmm.
And I think above all, he'll be remembered for, you know, he created the sound that he was the first to put voice and instrument together in the way he did. There are many people who followed, but he was the architect. And it, you know, he was also the first person to ever perform in stereo.
Oh, really? No, I didn't know that.
Yes.
Wow.
And the first Western artist to go to Russia. So, and amazingly enough, I think there's also a big legacy for him in young composers.
Mm-hmm.
There's not a young film composer I've met who's not been inspired by my father's arrangements. So I think that, you know, it's a great legacy, and, you know, and I aspire to take good care of it and keep his music alive.
That's wonderful. And it's nice to hear you speak of him with such pride.
Oh, yeah.
Who can't appreciate that? Well, Tamara, thank you so much for joining us at Mr. Media this week.
It was my pleasure.
Thank you. Enjoyed it. Folks, if you'd like to keep up with Mr. Media's Friday interviews, you can subscribe to the site via email at www.mrmedia.com. You can also subscribe to the audio feed in the podcast section of iTunes. Thanks for joining us. Please come back next week for another Fridays with Mr. Media.